How's it going, Eric?
Hey, mate. Good to see you. I'm great.
How was your Christmas?
Christmas was great. We surprised our boys with a trip to Canada, and so they didn't know. And so on Christmas Eve, we told them, and then 3 days later, we got on a flight and were there to surprise my dad for his 80th. And it was amazing. I dressed my 4-year-old up as a pilot. It was his Halloween costume, so I made him wear it.
Okay.
And then we got invited into the cockpit before the flight, and then again when we were flying over Greenland, which never happens. And I mean, that was like 5 hours into the trip. So you add on to that, sledding and snow and watching hockey and seeing family. It was awesome. We just got back a couple of days ago, so I'm a little still a little foggy.
Yeah, no, and that's it's a big well, still a big age to get to 80, you know. Sometimes you do think, as a man, you think, geez, like it feels far away, but it doesn't feel how far away at the same time. You want to get there at least, you know, 80 and beyond, you know, in a good physical, mental state, you know.
Yeah, and I highly recommend going to an 80th birthday party, both for the fact that like it was from 2 until 5 p.m., but it ended at 4. Like 80-year-olds are like, I ain't got time for this, right? And everyone's like just sitting down chatting. Like it was so nice. My sister and I, we cleaned up after, and then I looked at my watch. I'm like, it's 5:15. Like I can't. This is great. I could still
That's
watch a
fast.
movie and be bed by 7:30. It was incredible. So it's like you finally figure it out at 80. You're like, what have I been doing partying at 9 p.m.? That's 2 to 5 p.m. That's where it's at.
I like it. It's just very efficient, isn't it? It's just like, look, we've done our
Super
thing now.
efficient. And it
Let's
was
go
great because
away.
there's no, we're not feeding you lunch, we're not feeding you dinner. You're coming in, you're gonna have a bit of cake, and off you go.
Yeah,
Right? It was super.
I'm pleased to see you now. That pleasure is now sort of waning. Time to move
Exactly. We all feel it, where when we're younger, we're just too polite to like kick people out. But if the
Yeah.
party ends at 5, you can be like, all
Yeah.
right.
No, I think, yeah, fair.
How about yourself? How was your Christmas?
Yeah, it's good. I moved house and just, you know, getting everything ready for the
Unpacking.
kids. Yeah, so it's still a process of getting the house to become like a home. But we're slowly getting there. Yeah, it's been good. I've still got bits of work to do. I'm heading to Bermuda tomorrow for this
Wow.
race challenge, which will be really fun. No, I'm doing well.
And the moves are hard. I mean, you get, 80% of the packing done in the first unpacking done in the first month, and then the last 10% take, I don't know, forever. I mean, like 50 years later, you still find boxes that you think, maybe I should unpack this,
Yeah. The funny thing is that when you're packing, you probably could relate to this as well. You've got all this stuff, and it's like, why have I got this? Like, what am I gonna do with this? There's no need to keep it.
I purge a couple times a year, and I think everything I went through in 2020, that was just like a good time to purge as well. And I'm okay with it. I think it's really hard emotionally to just go through your stuff and say, I'm gonna bin this. But once you get over that, it can be a little crazy, and then you look back and you're just like, oh man, I threw away everything. I don't even have a swimsuit now,
But yeah, no, thank you for like jumping on the podcast. I've kind of changed things slightly. As I said to you before, like quite a few people do approach me to come on the podcast. And I think just because the last year has been so hectic, I just didn't get a chance to respond back to everyone. And after speaking to you, I was like really keen just to like we had like a really great conversation. And that was sort of really sort of kept me in my mind thinking, I've got to get this booked with Eric next year. So first of all, apologies for my side of sort of delaying it, and thank you for coming on, because I think we were looking to do last year, but just with the house move and everything, it just wasn't possible. Life happens, you know. So
Here we are.
yeah, exactly. Like I said, I was really blown away by your story, and I mean, story almost feels a bit like light to us. It's almost like making it seem smaller than it is, but just your life experience and just your perspective, I think that's really what impresses me most. And I think sometimes you hear the stories that you probably need to hear at the time. So that's what has really impressed me, to be honest. I mean,
Right.
before we get into the conversation, I'd love to know a little bit more about who Eric is and like a little bit more about your
Okay.
background.
So I have a pretty surprising background. I was born in Guatemala to a father who's Dutch and my mother's Canadian. And just because my father was living there, or my parents were living there, so you know, there I was born, and that helped me a lot in life, because I realized, you know, the world was bigger than mine and my best friend's backyard, which a lot of people have as a childhood experience. They don't really see the world as a bigger place, but I did. So I grew up in Canada, and then when I was 20, I headed abroad, and I've been abroad ever since. I've spent 5 years in China. I spent 6 years in Sweden, and I learned the languages in those countries, and I gained Swedish citizenship after living there so long. I lived in Switzerland for 6 years, Dubai for 3 years, and now Germany for 3 years. And I have three young boys. They are now 4, 6, and 9. And I've always been very comfortable and prefer to be in uncomfortable situations, which may be a little bit revealing about my story as to why I coped as well as I did, because I've always been in countries where I didn't know the language or I didn't know how to behave. And so being a fish out of water for me is my preference. I like those daily challenges and having to use my head to just grocery shop and get from A to B. And so that's a little bit of how I ended up here in Germany.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Just the idea of putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. You're not saying dangerous situations, but you're more about moving to a new country and, you know, finding out about that culture and fitting in type thing.
Yeah, I think that there's probably parallels to those of us who like sport and running in particular, is those daily wins and those daily like small challenges to say, well, I'm going to see if I can run at a better pace or a more difficult track. And it's just like, oh yeah, I was able to do it. And that is a nod to how I've approached my life, where not really by decision, but I've just realized that I'm much more comfortable in having those daily challenges and living in a country where, you know, you have to respect the culture as Ramadan is happening in the background, or, and you're like, okay, so what does this mean? And how should I, you know, incorporate that into my life? Or living in China during, you know, in 1997, I was there, which was a pretty special year. And then I went back for 5 years, and even living in Germany is like quite a culture shock, you know, for anyone who's been here. Every day I'm like, oh my God, I really live in Germany. You know, yeah, it's the one thing I love living here, except that it's really sometimes too German. And so I'm just like, I have to laugh about that. But, you know, not being able to navigate bureaucracy, paperwork, talk to doctors, talk to teachers, it's challenging. But as soon as that, you know, we were back in Canada over the holidays, and I just found everything so easy, the shopping, the communicating, the getting from A to B, that it was borderline, and not even borderline, it was literally boring. I was like, okay, yeah. I got through my day, but I don't feel fatigued. I was like, okay, I need more of a challenge. And I think that's sort of defined my life for the last 25 years.
It's really interesting. I think some people, in not all cases, some people are running away from something and some people aren't running away from something. They just enjoy that challenge. Like, you hear it sometimes with sports people, they search out like that discomfort. And it seems like you're on the latter.
Very much so. And it's, I mean, without ever really trying to unravel the mystery of it, I think part of it is that it puts things in perspective. And so if you feel a win by just going to the grocery store and finding foods that you like, and it puts life in perspective that, you know, these small challenges that you go through all day, if you get quite good at navigating them and maintaining a low stress, then the bigger stuff, kind of, you're better equipped for it, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I sort of like the idea that I've, you know, been sharp, you know, smoothing the rough edges of my ability to manage stress, that when big stressors come along, like stuff that really matters, then you feel, hey, I've handled 100 small stressors. This bigger thing might not be as daunting as it seems on face value.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So this is quite a big two-part question. The first part is, life challenges us all. It knocks us down. Can you talk about how life did this for you? And secondly, can you talk about how you navigated an extremely tough point in your life and how did you find your why so you didn't get stuck?
Right. So I think that the two bookends to my experience were really that it all was in 2020. And so that from pretty much January till December. And I mean, of course, I'm still experiencing it now, but 2020 is sort of the kind of my dark year. So at the time in January of 2020, my wife and I had three young children, one that was 6 months old, one that was 3, and one 5 years old. And we had recently moved to Germany, where our youngest was born, and I was still working in a job in Dubai. We had lived in Dubai for a few years. So I was going back and forth, and it was all very clumsy, but we made it work. And in February, she was diagnosed with a very rare type of cancer. It's called small cell cancer. And it basically grows so quickly in when someone has it that they only catch it in very late stages. And in her case, it was a 4B cancer, meaning that it was basically had riddled her body when it was detected, that there was a tumor on her cervix, half of her liver was gone, and they found around 10 tumors in her brain. And that was, you know, week one. Within a couple of weeks, we had figured out that she had 4 months to live. And there was a few challenges in that. I mean, one, the obvious, getting your head wrapped around the fact that you're going to lose your love of your life and your partner and the mother to your children. And also sort of indirect challenges and stressors in that, like, how do you share this with people? Like, how do you tell your parents? How do you tell your kids? So we kept the fact that it was terminal to ourselves and just told people that she had cancer. I, of course, started, you know, suddenly I had to think about work and how am I going to raise three kids on my own? And you're oddly, she would be going to chemotherapy and I'd be on my phone Googling like how to be a widower, because you know, no one ever sits you down and explains if this ever happens, here's how you do it. And it's such a weird thing to Google. And then you're finding articles about men who've lost their wives and raised kids and they made a go of it. So you're like, okay, well, maybe it'll work out for me. But it's terrifying and it's so scary. And I think the scary part of it is this heavier layer on top of the sad layer. You know, the sadness is overwhelming grief coupled with excruciating fear. You know, you're almost paralyzed with that fear. She passed away 5 months later, in July of 2020, right after our youngest turned one. And I found myself a father to three young boys who really needed me, who didn't quite grasp what had happened. So they were innocent and protected from they're sort of shielded from what I was going through, except that I was in this horrible, sad state when they sensed that, but they didn't quite get the fact that their mom had died. Of course, our 5-year-old did, but the 1-year-old, I mean, was completely shielded from it. And I found myself in a country that's not my own. I was in Germany and I didn't speak German and I didn't know anyone. Her parents lived close by, so they helped in keeping an eye on the kids. But they were also incredibly sad. You know, they had just lost their daughter. So you can definitely tap into them for help, but you're not really leaning on a stable person when you're asking that person for help. And besides them, I didn't know anybody else in Germany. And it was COVID on top of all that. And what was the hardest part about COVID was this strong sense that nobody really knew what was going on. And so there was more fear than knowledge in year one of COVID in 2020. You know, people were doing some really absurd things like washing their groceries when they got home, or, you know, I, like other people, I was wearing surgical gloves in the grocery store. And of course, that was going on. And a lot of people on social media were like, oh, this is the worst. And I was like, well, it could be worse, right? So for me, that year wasn't just about this event, but it was about this the layers of that event, that it was losing a partner, becoming a widower, becoming a father to three young children I had to take care of my own, thinking about career, being in a country which wasn't my first choice, although I love many things about it. It's still not my home country. And then COVID meant that literally my friends and family couldn't come visit me and help me and hug me. And in that year, I had met a friend while on a trip in Dubai in January. And the next time I sat down with a friend face to face was October. And it was for 2 days, someone came to visit me. But I didn't see, my sister couldn't, was the first who could come out. And the first time she could come visit me was February of 2021. So 6 months after my wife passed away, I finally had someone who could come and, you know, ask how I was doing, and, you know, face to face, besides the many text messages I was getting. So that was my 2020. And it was a rough year. And I think for your listeners that feel that there is an element of challenge in their life, I strongly associate that with that. And I know what it means to have a really rough go of it. It really defined my year.
I've got so many questions, but one of the things that sort of jumped to my mind was that listening to you describe it, it's almost like the tone of your voice hasn't changed since the start. I mean, there's a few breaks, but it's like you can tell that you've worked your way through it. It's still painful, but you can tell you've worked your way through it. And right. With something so painful, not so painful, but something so such a difficult moment we talk about, what do you hope to share with the listeners? Why do you want to share this story with the public? Because like you could just be right. Like, look, I've got the tools, I don't need to share it myself. What is it in you that you want to share that with other people?
I think there's two moments. I remember there's a lot of answers to that question, right? So I'll pick out a couple of them. A few days after my wife passed, I was grocery shopping and I had one of my sons with me, and I was standing in line to pay, and there's someone in front of me and someone behind me. And I looked around and I thought, nobody who's looking at me knows my wife died 2 days ago. They don't know that I'm not German. They don't know that I'm facing the challenge of raising three young boys on my own. And what I learned from that moment was, and we all know it, until we don't really know it until we know it, which is you don't know what someone beside you is going through, someone in the car beside you in traffic, or someone in front of you in the grocery store. It could be as extreme that they've just lost someone they loved, a parent or a spouse or a sibling or a child. And so the amount of empathy I drew from that was beyond measure. Telling the story now is a lot about, you know, I haven't really been able to talk about it until now. And one of the reasons why, you know, as you mentioned, the way I can discuss it is that I had to do a few things to get through that time, and they worked out. And I've learned a lot about how to cope through something like that. And I felt like part of it was, certainly there's an element of luck that, you know, something, there was a certain elements that helped me get through it, but I also had to figure it out. And now that I have this body of knowledge, it's not from research, I'm not an expert, but it's someone who lived it. And I can sort of like describe the war from having been in the trenches. I think there's a value in that from people who feel like they're also in their own trench.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I really love that point, like you're saying, you can look at someone next to you, you just don't know what they're going through, just the way that we present. Can you talk a little bit about just some of the things that probably worked for you and probably didn't work for you to get to this stage? And I appreciate you're not saying this, like you're saying, these are the five steps to overcome whatever. You're just saying, this is what worked for me, but what might work for you might be different. But just be good for people to hear your experiences of what worked and didn't work so they can maybe implement that in their own lives.
Absolutely. And I'm grateful that these things worked, and it wasn't that it was pure luck. I wanted to get through it. I had these three boys looking up to me, and I didn't want to have I'm not a wallower, right? I didn't want to feel continually sad. It's not who I am. So I wanted to move past this difficult time, not as quick as possible, but I just wanted to feel like I could put it behind me. So I started researching how I could get through this. The first thing I think that when you come out of any traumatic situation is I was surprised by how restless I felt. I had a lot of energy that just had to go somewhere. I mean, I had been caring for my wife for a few months as much as I could, and thinking and thinking and thinking about this pending day, and then it finally was upon me, and then I was just like, okay, now what? So I had this energy that was weird energy, so I had to do something with it. So I did something physical with it, and I just started doing push-ups. Like, I was like, okay, I have to just get on the ground and move. And keep in mind, I only did 2 push-ups on the first day. I mean, I was still pretty fatigued from the grief, but I did 2 push-ups. And that's sort of what was born. And the next day I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do 4. And then the next day I did 6. And the next day I did 8. And it turned into this thing where for, let's say 2 push-ups takes you 10 seconds. But for 10 seconds, I was granted a break from thinking about these very big thoughts of how am I going to get through this. For 10 seconds, I was given respite, which was meaningful. And so the next day was 20 seconds, and the next day was 30 seconds. And so I started occupying myself, learning that physical activity really took my mind off of, you know, thoughts that I couldn't turn off. I would wake up thinking about how would I get through this? And it was from every moment of consciousness, that's all I was thinking about, except when I was doing something active. So that was the first thing. And it was tricky with 3 boys to do more than just push-ups. I could do push-ups with them around. So that led to, okay, I needed to do more. So once they were asleep, like 7 o'clock, I started in the house we were renting, I started running up and down the stairs. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do 100 flights of stairs, but it's going to be up and down the stairs. And it's odd. You're at home and you're just like, okay, I guess this is the workout that no one ever talks about, but I'm just going to go up and down my flight of stairs. And then I started feeling a little better, you know, maybe it was just endorphins, but I did this thing and it made me feel less horrible. I was like, hey, this is how I want to feel all the time. So I'm just going to do this more often. Then it started snowballing. And I think a lot of people who have improved their life through fitness can associate with this story, which was, you know, exercise led to better eating, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm going to eat better and I'm going to cut this out, or I'm going to add more of that. I'm going to drink more water. I'm going to get better sleep, and I'm going to meditate. I'm going to start stretching. Looking back on it, what I did was life really slowed down during that time. And for all of us during COVID, everything sort of slowed down, but I added one thing a month. So I said, okay, this month I'm going to start drinking X amount of liters of water a day, whatever the amount was. Or this month I'm going to start taking multivitamins. Or this month I'm going to start doing those 10,000 steps a day. Now, looking back, the compound, all of it was extremely helpful. But I will say to listeners, you know, you may have this list of all these things you want to do, but tackle it one at a time. One will naturally lead to another. It will reveal itself. If you do one thing, the next thing will naturally reveal itself. And it wasn't until about 4 or 5 months later that I started running again. You know, my in-laws at the time were able to take the kids for the weekend. So I was like, okay, now I can go for a run. And the running was a big change. And looking back on it, the difference between running and all the other things I was doing was that running took me outside. And the fresh air and the sunshine, you know, pick up any book on the topic and you'll learn quickly how therapeutic it is. And grief and post-traumatic experiences are very indoor activities. Grief tends to be an indoor activity. And even when we visualize someone going through a tough time, you know, they're on the couch, they've got a blanket, they're kind of wallowing and feeling terrible. That's an indoor thing. Okay, now and then you sit on a park bench and you feel bad. But it's more difficult to feel down when you're outside. And running tends to be a sport that takes you outside. So that was a little bit of how it unfolded for me near the end of 2020. And until today.
There's so many things in that you said that I want to touch on, really. I feel like it's really, I think one of the subtle things is we talked about at the beginning about you've got the difficult feelings that you're feeling, but then you do a difficult physical activity and it almost counterbalances it. And it's really interesting to know like what's happening in the mind then. It's almost like, I'm probably putting words in your mouth, like, I'm doing this, so it gives me a little strength to manage this.
Yeah, right.
Is that kind of what it was like?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, there is this, I mean, for anyone who's been on a really hard run or anything physically very difficult, it can really hurt. It can be like self-destructive. But I would look back at it as pain substitution. I was able to substitute heartache with shin splints. And it was wonderful to have shin splints instead of heartache. Mm-hmm. And that pain substitution was so welcome that I would much, you know, of course I was going to feel sad and scared, but if I can replace that with classic muscle ache and fatigue, God, it felt great just to have muscle ache for a while. And sort of was tricking my mind into moving this pain that I had inside of me to a much more physical pain, which tends to go away faster, right? You go for a hard run, you might feel bad for a day, maybe two. I mean, maybe at the marathon, you feel bad for a week or two. But with trauma, it can be there a long time. And there's this, it's so slow moving that you don't feel the healing. It's like you feel the same as you did the day before and the day before that and the day before that. You just feel horrible. But from exercise, if I feel horrible tomorrow, the day after I'm going to feel a little better. And the day after that, I'm going to feel a little better. And you're like, wow, I can feel myself healing. Emotionally, I couldn't feel it. But physically, it was like, oh, I'm getting better. And it was tricking my brain into thinking, hey, I'm on a healing journey here. And that was important to know.
There's two things that I thought of when you were just saying that. I guess the first one, although you've got the physical side that allows you to do the thing and move forward, can you talk about the brain processes? Because sometimes you haven't always got the physical thing there. Like you said, it's something that came later. Like, for example, I had an opportunity where I was with Joan Benoit Samuelson, and she was preparing for the London Marathon. I think this was last year. And she was coming off an injury. And I remember she started this sentence where she was like, started talking about this injury. And she just stopped herself dead. And he went, nope. And she just corrected her sentence and she just reframed it. I was just sitting there like, wow, like, even though you're retired, that is why you're a champion, because that is the mindset of like how you can switch around and just be conscious of that. Using those words aren't serving you, because words are really powerful. Can you talk about, like, do you have a kind of similar sort of process, and like how does that work for you when you haven't got the exercise element to it as well?
Are you speaking more in terms of like how I was able to sort of mentally get myself out and doing things, like how I was able to motivate myself, or?
Yeah, just the mental process. Like sometimes, like you said, even before, it's just like with the feelings, you know, they don't, it's like a slow moving ship, and sometimes you just don't realize you're in it until you can snap out of it, like, because you don't have someone to pull yourself out. But like you said in the beginning, like, it was during lockdown, you're indoors, they're struggling, so you haven't got, you can't rely on them. Your sister didn't come until 6 months later, so a lot of the time you're on your own, and like you said, you've got your three boys there. I'm just really interested in that mindset of like how you sort of like recognize a thought and then reframed it.
There was an aha moment for me when it was a week or two later, and I took my kids to the park. The sun was shining, it was July, and they were having a great time, and they were going down the slide, and they were like, "Papa, Papa, look at me." And I was really happy, and I was excited to see them in a great mood. And I was also really sad. And the aha moment was, oh, I can have both of these things within me at the same time. It's you don't have to wait for your sadness or trauma to subside to replace it with something that's joyful and wonderful. Those two things can coexist. You can be happy and sad simultaneously. And that allowed me to, you know, unburden myself from this potential guilt of moving past the trauma. And a lot of people who go through a rough time, regardless of what it is, one of the difficult things is to allow yourself to be happy again. Specifically, I felt there was a lot of eyeballs on me. There were friends and family of my wife who I felt wanted me to be sad. You know, relative, we were together 15 years. And the idea would be that, okay, well, he has to be brokenhearted for the rest of his life. That's the only thing that's going to truly reflect how much he loved her. If the rest of his life is broken, he has to commit the rest of his life to this tragedy. Mm. And I wasn't game for that. That doesn't match me. That's not for me. And so as I started feeling happy, whether it was just watching my kids play, I felt guilty about being happy. And then I realized, well, actually, I am happy and sad. So I'm still respecting the memory of her, but I'm also enjoying the moment. So that helped me a great deal to think, hey, it's okay to go out for a run. And the first few times were really hard to give myself permission to do something quite normal and almost enjoyable, right? I love running. And so it almost felt wrong to be doing something that I loved when I should have really been brokenhearted and full stop brokenhearted. Yeah. And I think to an earlier point you made, and I do want to stress this and underline it for everybody who sort of feels themselves like that life has gotten too big and they've been knocked down too far, is that how do you get out there and do that run when you're just weighed down in grief or sadness or fear? How do you do it? And looking back on it, and even at the moment I had to unravel it, there's two parts to it. The first is you have to take inventory. And although an emotional trauma is it has its challenges that it's not visible to other people. Like you can be in the grocery store and everybody thinks you're normal, but in fact, inside you're destroyed. Take inventory. Your body still works. Your legs work. Your arms work. You can breathe. And that allows you to do so many things. So take that inventory and say, okay, I can't do this and this. I can't carry on a conversation with someone, right? And I can't answer emails. Like my brain is fried. But I can walk, I can get outside, I can move. So that inventory is quite important. Be clear about what you can and can't do. And running is very special compared to other sports because you can do it on your own. You can't, like I also enjoy playing volleyball, but you know, there were days where I was running and I was crying during the run. And that would have been really creepy if I was playing volleyball and I was crying the entire game. My teammates would look at me like, okay, weirdo, what are you doing here? So crying, you can do it on your own. And so you can cry while you run. You can mask it, go for a run in the rain. No one will notice. But I cried before runs, during runs, after runs. You know, sometimes you finish a great run and you're like, yes. And then you just start bawling. So that was one of the things I would say, really take inventory, but what you can do so that in that moment, you know, I've already thought about this before. I know I can do this. The second part of it is to figure out your motivation. You have to make your motivation. Now, in that moment where you're on the couch and you're staring at your running shoes and it's okay weather outside, maybe it's too windy or too cloudy or too rainy and lots of excuses for you not to run, but you know you want to. There's a part of you that's like, hey, we should do this. You have to have a list. You have to have your motivational reasons ready to go. In that moment, it's going to be really easy to talk yourself out of doing it. So figure out your motivation prior to that moment. And for me, what I learned was that there were two types of motivations. And for simplicity's sake, we'll call them negative motivation and positive motivation. Negative motivation are really dark thoughts. They are things that you dislike about yourself. I'm too fat. I hate my ex-girlfriend. I hate my boss. There's something I don't like about myself. I feel sad or grief, and you're just like, oh, and it's just this like such discomfort. You want to run away. And these are these demons of motivation. Yeah, they're horrible, but they work. Tap into them. If you're thinking about an ex that makes you crazy, tap into that energy. It'll get your ass moving. If for nothing else, use that dark thought to go and do a 3K run or a 10K run or a 30K run. And during your run, use it again and again. You know, I had a friend pass away in 2009. And as I was running, I was thinking about him and my wife who I just lost. And I was running and I was thinking, yeah, but they can't run and I can. So I was going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But you know what? It worked. I finished my run. And so those dark motivations, those negative motivations, they do work. So preload them, store them, design them beforehand. And when you need them, tap into them. The positive motivations, hopefully they take over the negative ones. And those are things like, I want to run a best time or a personal best or a best pace, or I want to do a trail I've never done before, or I'm going to do a distance I've done before. I want to win a medal. I want to represent my country. I want to be an Olympian. These are about the goals that you want to achieve. This is about running towards something as opposed to running away from those demons. And as I've been running now for 3 years, I mean, I've been running a long time, but much more in the last 3 years, the negative motivations, they're there, but they don't really drive me like they used to. It's the positive ones of, hey, I want to prep for this half marathon or marathon. I want to do a run in this location. I want to do a run in this environment or setting. So it's much more about starting to accomplish things. And these are much more positive. And both of them really, really work. But in the moment, on the couch, staring at your shoes, you're not going to be able to motivate yourself. So get that list ready the night before, the day before, the week before, and just say, this is why I'm doing it. And pull those motivations out. Pull out that card in that moment and stare at it and say, and it could be dark, I get to run because she can't. And that will get your ass out the door. And at the end of the day, that's going to do wonders for you.
Thank you for sharing that. It's really powerful to hear about the background to the whys. Like you say, it's not always, you know, clicking your heels and like picking daisies and things like that. Sometimes it's the real dark motivations, but they do change. What I'm really interested in is just looking a bit wider than that, in terms of, like, you've talked about how, if you go back, how people were saying to you, oh, you should feel this. Now your wife has passed and you're like, well, no, it's not how I feel. But then you did admit to, you know, having those emotions come up. And I really like the fact that you talked about how feelings can coexist. That's what we spoke about in our last conversation, about you can be happy and sad at the same time. And you shouldn't feel bad about either, really. So this is the wider one. So how do you, like, talk about validating your own feelings, but also at the same time, and you don't have to share the exact examples, but you've got your three boys. Like, how do you validate their feelings of what they're going through? Because you're all going through common grief, but processing it differently and moving through it differently.
So certainly at the time, you know, having a 1 and a 3 and a 5 year old looking up at you, that's a big motivator too. And the voice in my head that was hammering on the idea that I had to step up and be ready to take care of these boys on my own was a call to action that I couldn't ignore. So I had enough motivation to power an army because I had to raise these boys on my own. And I did feel very solitary, being in a country that wasn't my own and not having, you know, friends and neighbors and a network close at hand. All of us felt very disconnected during COVID. And so if we needed someone, even if we were like sick and we wanted someone to make chicken soup for us, there was no one around. And so having them look up at me, it really magnified how I was feeling at the time. I don't think it was, and I think probably that helped me more than hindered me, because I had to, of course, prioritize them above me. And so that also gave me a break from a tough time. You know, when being useful is something that is far more important than we understand in our modern life, you know, having that feeling that people rely on you is very important. A lack of usefulness can be quite detrimental. And it's the exciting thing about being a parent is that these kids need you. They need you to wash their clothes and, you know, cook their carrots and take them to the playground and read them bedtime stories. And so I filled my life with that. And that gave me, that really powered me, is to sort of look at them looking at me and saying, these kids need me, so I better rise to the occasion. And it wasn't just, hey, I want to be a great dad so I can, you know, I want to be in good health so I can play with them on the playground, which I did. And I want to be able to run around with them, but I also wanted to be able to, you know, make their breakfast and go for a walk and just the basic stuff, right? And so I had to kind of shut off the grief. And I think that looking back on it, it's a weird thing to go through a tough time and then find ways to be useful. It's not really advice that I dish out if someone's bummed out, to be like, well, let's go and be useful. That'll help you. But the being important to other people really was profound for me at that time. And so I make sure that I'm still as useful as I can be in my life now. That's very important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know we touched upon it earlier about the push-ups. Can you talk a little bit about your social media page on Instagram?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, there was a few elements to it. So being alone in Germany at that time, the messages I received were pretty much copy-paste. Hey, how are you doing? Times 30 times a day from people I hadn't spoke to in 6 years, or people I hadn't, you know, people I'd spoke to the day before. And it, after a while, you want a different conversation. So entering into the social media stratosphere was just about having people make comments that weren't about this very heavy topic. I just needed a break from it. And I also found that being public with not the grief part of it, but just the exercise part of it, you tend to find those random people that are also cheering you on. You know, I have a follower who's an architect in the Philippines, and he's also doing push-ups, and it's just like I like his pictures and he likes mine, and it's just like, okay, he doesn't know all the backstory, and that's very comforting. So that was an important part of it, but I really wanted to feel better. I really wanted to heal. This was so important to me. So I felt that the physical journey was going to get me there. And I posted this online. I can't do much about my mental health right now, but I feel like I can do a lot about my physical health. And so I wanted to find as many ways to keep myself disciplined and honest as possible. And for me, it was, hey, if I post online, I'm going to do 30,000 pushups. I better do 30,000 pushups. And I did that. And so I started that in 2020 and I hit 20,000, I think around Christmas of 2021. And then I started sharing my runs and started sharing other things. And it wasn't a sort of ego boosting, although it strokes the ego and it makes you feel good. Mm-hmm. If people cheer on what is a big deal for you and say, hey, I did this run and it was really hard for me. And other people kind of pat you on the back and say, great job. Mm-hmm. It is a nice validation. But for me now, it's much more of a journal. And I can look back at those photos and you know, reels and stories that I shared in 2020 when I was at my worst. And to you or anyone else, it's like, okay, here's a video of a guy doing 10 pushups. Mm. And I look at it and I think, my God, I was so brokenhearted on that day. Like that was the day where I cried in the car for half an hour. And then I went inside and I did 10 pushups and made a video of it. That's what I remember. But what's helpful in that is the progress that you feel. And for anybody who really writes down their sporting achievements, if you went for a walk today and it's 100 meters, let me tell you, years from now, when you're doing 10K runs, you'll look back on that day and go, how far I've come. So for me, it's this combination. It's a diary of my mental and physical health. And so it's I have an Instagram account of Eric Push Pull Run. And the push was push-ups and the pull, I was doing pull-ups, and the run is the running. But it's also a second meaning of like this push and pull factor, you know, but motivated. There were motivations that were pushing me forward and motivations that were pulling me forward. And so I thought, okay, that's how I do it. So it's just it's like anyone in their 40s doing sport. It's just me and my 200 followers. You know what I mean? It's nothing.
Yeah, but you still have an impact on people's life though. So I think that's really
incredible. Yeah. And I think there have been 3 or 4 occasions where people reached out to me and they sent me a direct message. And, you know, especially when I share, and it's rare that I share anything about the grief, but they reach out to me and say, hey, how much it mattered to them, and whether they were just going through the loss of a parent or going through something very difficult themselves. And just to see someone 6 months ahead of them, 1 year ahead of them, doing well, gave them hope that, hey, if I keep at it, and I just keep breathing, then I'll get there. And at my worst time, the best advice came from my sister, who told me, you know, at my worst, on the day that my wife died, she said, just get through the next 10 seconds. And the next 10 seconds involves taking one deep breath. And after that 10 seconds, get through the next 10 seconds. And after that 10 seconds, get through the next 10 seconds. So I did not feel like I could get through the day. A day was beyond me. I looked at people getting through the day and thinking, how? Even making it to the next minute without feeling like I was going to collapse or hyperventilate or have a panic attack. I was like, oh my God, a minute from now, I'm still going to feel horrible. But the advice was just the next 10 seconds. And now, of course, like, and even at the time, thinking, making any plans for the next day was impossible. If someone's like, what are you doing tomorrow? I'm like, my brain doesn't do tomorrow. I can't talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow is this abstract concept, which everybody else gets to enjoy and I don't. And now I can make plans a year in advance, which is beyond comprehension from where I was a few years ago.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because you elaborated on a point that you mentioned earlier about just how the process can feel really slow. But in that
really slow
context, you really sort of broke it down to actually this point that you're saying, like, to get through the next few seconds feels like you're going to blow up. And just to get that advice, so just to slow it down and just be present, it's really important for people to hear. So, no, thank you for sharing and opening up about that.
You do. You feel sick to your stomach. The trauma, it's It's a real beast, you know, and it's this emotional response to an experience that you have that isn't temporary, right? It isn't something that you feel one day and it's gone the next day.
Yep.
Surprisingly, your body does have the tools to heal you through trauma. You just don't know it. It's like you have this airbag, like the airbag in your car. If you bought a car and you didn't know you had airbags and then you get in a crash and they deploy, you're like, oh, I didn't know that was there. It's the same thing. The tools to manage grief, the tools to heal yourself emotionally, they're inside of you. It's just very slow. You don't feel it. It's like glacial in its movement. Mm-hmm. And so that was one thing that I knew. Someone told me, hey, look, you're going to feel really bad, but your body will heal you. Just let it do its thing. But it will take years. So I thought, what do I do to pass the time until I feel better? Is it like, if am I facing this 2-year experience until I'm on my feet again, or 3 years or 1 year, whatever it takes, what am I going to do to pass the time? Yeah. So I thought, well, my legs work, I'll go for a run. And that led to so many things that have improved, and really why I'm still running today.
I think that's really powerful. And you talked about the tools that we have, but I think sometimes as humans, we can get so wrapped up thinking this is happening to me. And then you speak to other people who experience the same thing that you've gone through, and you pick up other mm-hmm. tools from other people. So mm-hmm. there's also that side as well. And it helps you work through it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, now I feel I have this unfair advantage over everybody in that I really had to step back and look at how do I get through a day, and you develop a keen sense of the tools that work for you and the tools that don't, and then you can use them over and over again. It's like a superpower. Now, for me, going into this experience, I've never been anyone that seeks out like a pharmaceutical solution. So I'm not someone who's like, yeah, okay, I'll take a painkiller. Like, I'm not crazy, but like, a lot of doctors were like, hey, you're going to feel horrible, and here's some pills that you could take to feel better. And I was like, no, that's not me. And I think it's very tempting because I really wanted to feel better really fast. Mm. So it was very tempting to be like, hey, if this is going to make me feel better in an hour, I really want it, but it's not real. So I wasn't a fan of sort of medicating myself through this. Secondly, I think the idea of therapy is great for most people, also probably me, but you know, a lot of German therapists, I went to a couple of them, their English isn't great, and my German isn't good enough to explain how I felt. So I'm like, well, I can't really talk to anybody about this. Mm-hmm. I guess I can do it online, but you know, by the time it's 8 p.m. and my kids are asleep, I'm exhausted. I didn't have the energy to get through this. So medication was sort of not an option. Therapy was not really an option. And looking back on it, fitness and better sleep and better diet and more water and fresh air saved me, healed me. And I wish there was more advocacy for it as the default solution for tough times. Now, it's very condescending if someone's going through a difficult time to just say, go for a walk, you'll feel better. Mm. And so we tend to shy away from that because you don't feel better after a walk. You feel better after 100 or a year of walks or 3 years of walks. Mm. You feel like you can look back and say, I have done a lot to heal. And your brain kind of thanks you for it. Your brain says, hey, you've done, you know, I'm going to meet you halfway. You've done the physical work, I'll do the mental healing as well. And you kind of, everything kind of comes together. But it's, I think it would be very condescending if you went to, if a friend or a family member or a doctor said, you know, you lost your wife, what you need is 10 minutes of sunshine and you'll feel better. It's a lie. But a couple of years of being outside as opposed to being in your basement and sitting in front of Netflix, if you had 2 years of Netflix versus 2 years of hiking, everyone knows which one is going to make you feel better. It's just not in that moment, right?
I really love that clarification you've given, because I think a lot of people have a narrative, and you gave such a perfect example. Go out for a run and you feel better. And sometimes you go out for a run and you don't feel better. You think, oh man, is it just me? But like you're saying, it's the 20th run. It's the, do you know what I mean? That multiplier, which really makes a difference. Like that first run, you might feel crap. You mean, you might still feel crap in a second one, but you're kind of gradually moving that sort of slow ship forward, as opposed to where you were before. So I think it's really cool to hear that clarification. Really, I think it's really important.
And there's that lesson. I mean, we know that progress, whatever you're doing, whether you're trying to learn guitar or learn to dance or bake or cook, it's a two-step forward, one-step back, or it's a two-step forward, three-steps back process. But you don't know that if you take one step. You learn that after 100. You learn that after 100 runs, that out of 100 runs, there's going to be quite a few bad runs. And the best thing, though, is that you can be sure you're going to have a bad run. You look outside, it's raining, you're kind of achy. You get out on your run, your shoes don't feel good. You know, your quads are kind of screaming. And an hour later you finish and there's no one around, but you just want to tell someone, I just had the best run of my life. So those really amazing moments come out of nowhere, but you're not going to have them if you run one time or walk one time. You have them out of 100 times. You're going to have 12 or 13 of your greatest runs of your life. And those are really addictive. You want them all the time. And even when I'm like, hey, I had a good sleep and I had a great breakfast, I'm going to have the best run ever. And you go charging out in like 10 minutes and you're like, this is horrible. This is the worst run I've ever had. And then you're like walking and you're just like, oh man. But you know, tomorrow might surprise you. Right. You have that knowledge that you can whip out. And that goes back to our original point of having a life filled with small challenges means that, look, tomorrow could be great. It could also be terrible, but you know, really facing that challenge and trying to sort of win in that moment again and again and again will get you to the point where the big challenges feel really manageable. And my 2020 as a challenge was, I mean, I don't wish it on anyone. And describing it, I still don't quite get how I came out of that car crash, like that figurative car crash alive. Like this year was just horrific. I still don't quite get how I got through it. But I think that now I know if I had to do something like that all over again, I'd be well equipped to handle it.
You know, we've been talking for about an hour or so, and it's hard to compress several years within an hour or longer. You've actually got a new partner, and she was actually really instrumental in your first run.
Right, right.
Can you talk about how she helped you through that healing process?
So we met online, and you know, that was really all I was able to sort of, you know, manage for interaction. It was great to start having more online relationships and with her in particular, and just with friends that weren't asking me how I felt, but just sending me like stupid memes and making me laugh all day. And that was great. So I needed that. I'm a really social person, so that was important to me. And, you know, it was, of course, through COVID, and she suggested this virtual 5K runs. And it was like, it was kind of funny. We all look back on these COVID memories of these silly things we do. And for those of us who run, we're like, do you remember those virtual runs we did? Where it was like, we would even get a medal from some random company. It was like, okay, I guess I did that. And so she said, why don't you do a virtual 5K? And her goal was to finish it in under half an hour. And so I was like, okay, well, it's like a month off. I'm going to train. And then I remembered, I had been running all my life. I had not done it in the last, 18 months. So I was like, I went out for a run and it was great. And so she was quite surprised. She was like, oh, you're actually a pretty good runner. I was like, I am a pretty good runner. And I really like how it made me feel. And preparing for it was great. And this is something that I would really stress for anyone who wants to incorporate fitness as a way to sort of navigate a mental health challenge is to sign up for a race, because, you know, you need that pressure to go for, you know, 10 training runs before you go out and compete in your 5K, or 20 training runs, or 30. And it's in doing many runs where the health benefits are going to, the mental health benefits come. So if you just say, oh, I'm going to run, it's very hard to just, okay, now 2 days later, I'm going to go for another one. Unless you have this looming deadline, that was very important to me. So that relationship grew, and she's an athlete herself. She plays volleyball, and it's been great. Now we've been together for quite some time, and we live together, and we're engaged to be married. And it's just like, you know, with three kids and two jobs, like, we know we want to get married, but it's like, this just feels like, I don't even know if it makes top 10 of the things that we're trying to like do in a day. Yeah. And I would also, looking back on it, she's such an advocate for sport and fitness. I mean, she's a rare partner in that I can go for a run and I can come back and tell her about it. And she's a really good job of like, either she's listening or she's convinced me she's listening. And for anyone who's like dating a runner, hearing about their paces and their splits and their lap times, and it's like the most boring conversation ever, but she does a great job of faking it. But she's an athlete, and so we can actually have conversations about our training and our diet and stuff, and we don't bore of it. And so when you trauma, or you know, any episode which marks the end of one chapter and sort of signals the start of a new chapter, it gives you an opportunity to make some significant changes in your life. Now, I made all kinds of changes, you know, diet and, you know, amount of water intake, and I bought a new bed and new sheets and all kinds of things. But you can also look at the people that you surround yourself with and take inventory of that and say, hey, are these people that every Friday they're like, let's meet at the pub and have a couple of pints? Or are these people who are like, hey, I'm doing a park run on Saturday morning, so actually Friday night, I want to get my sleep because I like this 5K run outside. And so as I was bringing, you know, I was rebuilding my network, I made sure that these were people that were very aspirational, that they were me, or they were a version of who I wanted to become. And so that's very hard to sort of like look at your group of friends and be like, okay, you're in and you're out. But when you're going through any kind of tough phase of your life, it's an opportunity to say, hey, listen, I'm going to change my job, so I'm going to change a few other things. And so spend more time around the people that you would like to become, and maybe less of the people that are holding you back. And I think that's advice that we hear a lot, but the opportunity to do it isn't so often that you have that.
And I guess, like you said, the time that you've gone through helps you really process kind of what's important and the time that you've got. And yeah, that makes sense. And I know you're not saying it in a very like cutting way, like, but it's just being mindful of those things and slowly.
No, and I'm glad you say it like that. Of course, the cliche is true. When someone you love dies, that cliche of life is short, man, that's a hammer that you cannot avoid. It will hit you on the head. And repeatedly. It's not a hammer. It's a woodpecker all day long. It's like, life is short, life is short, life is short.
Yeah.
And so you start feeling like, okay, I'm going to do more of this and less of that.
Yeah.
And it's hard because you'll make progress, and then you'll look around at the friends and family you have who haven't quite got to that point, and you wish it for them, and you sort of hope that they could embrace fitness as a way to make positive changes in their life. Maybe they will, maybe they'll be in that journey one day. You do want to become this advocate and preacher for embracing good and using your time the best you can, but you know, they're on their journey and they'll get there. And the best way you can convince anyone is to lead by example. And I know many of my friends have reached out to me and said, the fact that you were relatively open about, hey, I went through that, but here's how I'm doing and here's how it's going, has it really made a difference for them.
I just feel like it's right, because I think when you see people who are, I'll give you an example. So I was listening to a podcast, Stephen Bartlett, Diary of a CEO. There's a guy called Thierry Henry, an amazing ex-professional footballer. I'm an Arsenal fan, so like I was just like, wow, listening to him. And but listening to him open up about his struggles with some of the things that he's gone through, you're just like, wow, like if Thierry could do it, then I can do it. And like what you're saying, I think sometimes people need, I'm not comparing myself to Thierry to anyone like that, but it's just more the fact of seeing you're a huge hero, and that sort of brings it down to a level. But then the example that you're saying, it doesn't need to be a hero. It can just be someone that you know. You're right. Like, okay, right. Cool. Well, if my friend's doing this and I can experience it, it's okay for me to share this and be open about it. So I think that's right. Really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, I think some of these people that you know, using in your example, we sense that they have this huge network and unlimited resources to become a pro athlete and have the best sleep and nutrition and, you know, recovery techniques. Whereas I'm just Joe Neighbor. I'm a normal guy with 3 kids, with a job that fortunately I really love. And, it's a sort of an unusual story for a pretty usual person. You know, I have a bit of an international background, but that's about it. And I didn't really have to tap into a secret recipe. And that I think is an element of why I feel now I want to share this story, is that these are simple things that I did, and it helped me navigate through very much not a simple situation. It was extremely complex. And this is one thing about grief, is that it's complicated and it's changing and it's not the same. You know, my trauma is not the same as yours, but the tools that help me are available. They are better sleep, you know, better diet, more water, and then running. And I do want to share one thing about, we've spoken a little bit about, or quite a bit about, you know, that experience in 2020 and how I was able to sort of come out of that gauntlet. But I still use a lot of these techniques today. And so one of the things that really mattered at the time was to take my mind off of, you know, this woodpecker hammering away at my head. I just wanted a break from it. So I had also had heard in a podcast, and I had read about this this technique you can do when you're running, this bottom-up technique. So I started doing it. And this technique is, you're out running, you start thinking about your feet. And or first you start thinking about your shoes. So you think like, okay, are my shoes tight? Are my laces tight enough? Spend about a minute thinking about that. So you're running, you think about your shoes for a minute. And then you start thinking about your feet, how are your feet striking the ground? Then you think about your ankles. Are your ankles, you have mobility? And you work your way up your body. You think about your calves, your knees, your quads, your hips, your chest, your shoulders, your arms. And then lastly, you start thinking about your eyes, and you start thinking about your breathing. And then you start thinking about your mind, and you think, why am I running? So after you've gone through your whole body, that takes, could be 5 minutes, could be 10 minutes. And you know, okay, all systems go. Let's do a mental health check during this run. Why am I running today? Why am I out here? And that comes back to that motivation. I'm running because she can't. I'm running because he can't. I'm running because I have these kids that rely on me. And then you start thinking about the larger picture of why I'm running, which is the larger picture of why I'm running is, what are my goals? Mm-hmm. Right? Am I running away from something? Do I want to be a better version of myself? Do I want to lose weight? Do I want to look better? And then the last thing in that mental health check when you're running is, how do I want to feel when I finish today's run? Start to visualize it. Let's say you're out doing a 5K run and you're at 3K and you're like, oh, this is the two-third point where you're like, now I just want to walk. Like, I've done 3.2K, I just want to walk home. And then you have to think, how am I going to feel if I walk, or how am I going to feel if I run the 5K? And really visualize that feeling. And then you start, you start thinking, I'm going to feel great. It's so weird to suddenly be sure that you'll feel great when the rest of your day is characterized with feeling rotten. But you're so sure, when I finish this run, I'm going to feel great. You get home and you finish your run and you feel great. You visualized it and you're there. And I still do that today. And now I do longer runs and more challenging ones. And sometimes not. Sometimes I just do the treadmill for 20 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. But I still think, when I finish this, how am I going to feel? And the answer is, I'm going to feel great. And then I do. And trust me, the confidence of knowing I'm going to feel great mattered so much when I felt so far from great the rest of my day.
That's really powerful. I love the process that you went through in terms of like starting from feet upwards and then getting to your mind. And conversely, it made me think of a episode where I was listening to Mark Zuckerberg talking about running. And he was saying, I mean, he's a super intelligent guy, so I don't want to cast any aspersions, but he was talking about...
Smarter than me, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. He was saying, like, the reason why he liked doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as opposed to running was because, like, you couldn't really... And I'm paraphrasing here. You got to listen to the full interview with Joe Rogan. But he was saying, like, it's the fact that you couldn't really switch off. You could let your mind wander. And sometimes that's the detriment. That's the thing he didn't always enjoy about running, was the fact that it could just be so expensive. And like you're saying, if you're in a really difficult moment, I'm sure this stuff he's thinking about is just like, I don't really want to think about that on the run, probably not, so I can at least focus it here. So I can understand that's probably why he was sort of saying it, but I thought it was really interesting how, like you're saying, like, sometimes the thing of running is that thoughts can just run away with you, and it's like, man, this is overwhelming, even in the moment where you're supposed to be like, I'm supposed to be feeling good, but I feel terrible right now because everything's just too much.
But every runner will tell you, you know, you feel physically and mentally rotten for the first 20%.
True.
And then you feel pretty good. And then you just coast. For me, it was always like I hit this 7K marker and then I could just run all day.
Yeah.
And that feeling is still quite important to me. Now, you know, now my day is full of challenges of, you know, now I have a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And I just flew to Canada with them and back alone. And it was challenging, to say the least. So my challenges are much more provincial in like getting kids to bed and getting them to try food and all the rest of the things that any parent can associate with. So that run, that going out there and giving myself a break from it and doing that, like you say, that bottom-up check. And then coming home and having told myself, hey, I'm going to feel great when this is finished. And sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I still need the mental break. And, you know, for someone who's gone through trauma, it has this weird way of kicking you in the balls throughout the year. At Christmas, at birthdays, you know, sometimes there'll be a sunset that reminds you exactly the moment how it felt. Like, I remember... you know, oh, this was the weather when I found out my wife had cancer. Or, you know, there'll be something weird like, oh, this is the same, you know, parking system in the parking lot as the hospital I used to go to for her chemotherapy. And you're just like, well, there's a kick in the balls that I wasn't expecting this morning. And so it's going to come up over and over again. And I think that the heart of why I wanted to share my experience was that, unfortunately, with trauma, as opposed to maybe other things, I don't really think that it goes away. It's going to be there for the rest of your life. It's important you develop the tools to live with this and overcome it, and not, you're not going to beat it, but having the ability to understand it and also know at any time there's something I can do to feel better. So if I have a bad day, Christmas is not a great time, or my birthday, or whatever was an important moment that you may have had with someone that was once there and now isn't, you can feel confident that you have a technique or a tool that'll help you get through that day. And I mean, that's extremely important. I mean, now I can function as a normal human being because I know at any moment, if something bad happens, I know what to do about it.
I think there's so many important points in there. I just want to just re-emphasize. I think you're saying, and it's simple, like you're saying, with grief, it's not something that people say time is a healer, but it doesn't go away. It's that acceptance of it being a part of your life, but not trying to run away from it. And when it does come up, having some tools in place that you know how to try to gain a sense of perspective, like you're saying, you could be going out and then you see a family doing something that you guys did and it takes you back and you weren't expecting it. You can't turn around and be like, can you stop doing that? You know, it's not their fault. But it's like, you know, they say, like, having those tools in your head to deal with that. And grief, and it's wider, and you talked about losing your wife. For other people, it could be losing their job or an end of a relationship or something else. Yeah. So like the body just registers it as grief and pain. So I think it definitely has wider scope, really. Not diminishing what you've gone through, by the way.
One thing. No, and look, having been through it, I realized there are more difficult versions than what I went through. And there are versions that maybe on the face value that were less challenging. For example, you know, I had a friend who lost his brother in a car accident, and he just got a phone call and your brother's died. And he didn't have closure. And I did. I got to say goodbye. I got to say thank you. And we got to have our last sushi dinners together, and we got to go for walks and sit outside and play badminton and do all that goofy stuff. Closure and lack of closure is, you know, not having closure is something that's going to dog you for the rest of your life. That's the playground for demons. I had it. And so I had time to discuss with her about how she would like to see her children's life unfold. And that was important because it unburdened me from this feeling that I would, you know, be surrounded with her spirit and ghost and be like, what would she want in this situation? Well, I knew. We talked about it and we got paperwork done. So that for me felt extremely lucky in a weird way for like such a dark thing to think that I had a good version of a bad experience. So that relativism is quite important to keep. And I think that, of course, there's going to be people who listen to this and say, some people are going to think like, wow, what a heck of a year. I hope nothing like that ever happens to me. And there's going to be people who are like, I went through something 10 times worse. Or there's going to be people who say, I had a similar experience, but I was not as equipped as he was. Or there's people who had something, you know, so for them, it felt more insurmountable. But
for sure.
I think what's interesting about you and your podcast, and the theme comes back to running. And these are runners that are probably runners that are listening or aspiring runners. And, you know, you get to know any other runner. It seems that we all have a story of trauma in our background. For some reason, it's more than other sports that we're all kind of damaged goods. I don't know why. It's just someone has to do a poll on this and canvas runners at the next 10K and find out how many of us have like scars, emotional scars. And it's probably a lot of us. And my scores were objectively difficult ones. You know, it was objectively a really horrible time. I'm grateful. I want to say thank you to running and sort of the running community for people being open about how to stay motivated and everything from like what shoes to wear and what clothing to wear and your diet, because each one of those little elements of knowledge helped me do a run. And that run for me was really important. It made me feel good for a short amount of time on a day where I felt really bad. Yeah. So I think for anyone out there who's creating content around running or sharing their story, like you said, my story may help someone else, but many other people's story helped me, and I really needed it.
Yeah, that's powerful. I feel like this podcast could be a part two, because I feel like we've touched upon quite a significant part of your life, but there's also the other part of your life about the running and where that's gone to. One, I think, final bit before we kind of maybe pick up this conversation another time, I'd love to pick it up again, would be just to, what would you leave the listeners is like, what's your goals for 2024, like moving forward, like what's one final takeaway that you could leave?
Like any runner, I do have my goals. I did 72 runs last year, which is a good number. You know, it was over 700K, which is pretty reasonable for someone with three young boys and a job and a relationship. And so I think I'm pretty happy about that. So goal for 2024 is to go on 100 runs. I think it's a good number. And I think that it's more a comment on having those goals. And also the idea that having goals is a luxury, because it means that, you know, a certain amount of my life is figured out. In 2020, the idea of sitting down and going, what are my goals for the year? It was like breathe, you know, eat,
survive,
shower occasionally.
Yeah.
So the idea that like I can have a goal around running and distances is like, wow, I've really come a long way. So that's one of them. I really like 10Ks as a distance, because I'm a father, and after I do a race, I need to come home and play Monopoly with my kids and go for a hike. So there's times when I'll do a 10K in the morning, and then my kids are like, let's go hiking. And then we go for a 10K hike, and I'm like, oh my God. When I do a half marathon, I'm a little bit destroyed. Or if I even do a longer distance, I'm useless to my family for a week, and that's kind of unfair, and I don't want to do that. So I found that the distance where I can, like, if I can run in the morning and still cook dinner in the evening, that's a good distance. So I really like the 10Ks. I love the races. I think last year I did seven. I had a goal last year to do a sub 50 minute 10K, and I got it down to 47 minutes. Which was kind of fun because I'm 47 years old. So I was like, okay, I feel pretty great about a 47 minute 10K. And of course, then you go home and you Google like world record for senior men 10K. You're like, I'll be there in a year. You know, we all do it, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty much off the pace, but I like the idea that I'm progressing. So I think that's another goal, is to sort of just, and I think this is a lot about, you know, any runners, is that you start competing against yourself and saying, well, what do I want to do that shows an improvement over last year?
Yeah.
So that's a lot. I like running in different locations. So if I travel for work and say I'm going to be in Stockholm, I'm going to always bring my running shoes with me and run there. And then it becomes quite exciting to say I've run in this country and I've run that country. And so I think that there's a bit of element of that. But just to further refine the role of what running has done for me, to develop that, to continue nurturing it, because it has been quite important. My boys, they started doing runs last year. You know, they do these 700 meter little Bambino runs in Germany, and or 1.4K, and of course, they all go off at like light speed for the first 50 meters. And then they're all like exhausted by the end. And you're like, well, I still do that in my 40s. So I can't really like coach them out of it. So seeing that my kids are getting into it is really exciting as well. And those are my goals. And I think that, you know, a larger part of it is to just continually looking under those stones of ways to, small things I can do in the day to cope and to and not just get by, but to get ahead and to feel better, not just feel normal, feeling normal was my goal a couple of years ago. Like just getting back to zero was aspirational for me. And now I'm way above that. And so continuing to sort of self-improve, it's not a small thing, you know, yeah. But you got to budget time for it. You got to budget just energy, and you also have to budget money. You know, these new Nikes, they don't, they're not being delivered to my house. I don't know if Nike, if you're listening, I'm like a size 44, you know, send them my way, right?
There's still time. I like it. I think it's really cool.
Why not, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really cool though. Like you talked about, you know, going from that process of surviving to get to the point where you're thriving and having the goal. And I think it was really cool that you talked about, yes, you could go for all these big goals, but it's tied into the family. What's the point of, say, I'm going to run a 200 mile race, but if you're going out and doing these big runs and you're wrecked for the day, you're taking that time away from your kids. So it's like getting that balance right between you, when you're getting what you need, but you still have energy for everyone else. And I think that's really important to hear that, because I think sometimes with running, it's just like people join and they start running. They're like, oh, I've got to do a marathon straight away. You're like, you don't have to do a marathon straight away. You don't have to do a marathon to be a runner. You can keep a lot shorter.
No, I think if you take your running shoes with you on vacation, you're probably a runner, right? So if you've done one run and next week you're going on a vacation, take your shoes with you. And guess what? You're a runner now, right? Like if you back running shoes instead of like dancing shoes, not that I have dancing shoes. Kind of wish I did. No, it would speak a lot about my lifestyle, but I have a lot of running shoes. So take those with you. And that's great. That says a lot about your lifestyle. And now I'm looking around at my nieces and nephews and my own kids and thinking like, how can I use running as a way to motivate them and say, hey, if you do this run or you do enough training runs, there'll be a reward in it. For example, we're going on a camping trip to, now we live in Germany. It's like, hey, we'll go to Austria and we'll do a run there together, which is huge for a kid to be like, hey, we're going to do this run in another country. So it's like, how do we incorporate that? My kids, we are all extremely sporty and our life is, you know, there's a lot of sport and nutrition and fitness in it. And it's just kind of our wheelhouse. That's where we excel. And so we continue to develop that for sure.
I think it's really encouraging to hear that you sharing that with your kids, your wider family as well. One thing I want to ask before we kind of bring this conversation to a close is, first of all, can you share your Instagram profile? I know you mentioned it, just for people that didn't hear it. And secondly, is there any sort of final takeaways that you wanted to share that I didn't ask you?
The easier part is my Instagram is Eric Push Pull Run. So it's eric.push.pull.run. And I think that's you can kind of, it was less, 2 days ago, I hit 30,000 push-ups that I did in 11 months. So I do 120 to 150 a day. You know, I drop and do 16 to 20 whenever I have a chance. So if it's like I put the kettle on to boil water, okay, it's 2 minutes. I'm going to drop and do some push-ups and I have an app to track it. And then I get 1,000 done and then I get another 1,000. Then in a year, I got 30,000 push-ups done, which I think is not bad for someone who's 47. I think the main takeaway is that whether you see something very traumatic on your horizon that's going to hit you, like I knew that, you know, months before my wife passed away, that she was going to pass away, or it's just hit you, or you was a year ago or 10 years ago, that process to get back to normalcy, sure, there's, first of all, it's a recipe, you know, and the recipe is, could be running. It's, you know, better living, quit drinking, quit smoking, get more sleep, get more sunshine, stretch, more time with friends, take your dog for a walk. It's all of those ingredients need to go into the recipe. But like any cook will tell you, each ingredient requires a skill set. So take them one at a time. Now, I made a list and said, here are the 20 things I want to incorporate into my life, which was basically I just stole from all the books and podcasts and just listened and looked at smarter people. But I started with the easiest one. Honestly, the low-hanging fruit. One of them was multivitamins. I was like, well, if I take a multivitamin every day, then I'm somehow better. So I started with multivitamins. I'm not saying I still take multivitamins, but it was so easy to do. It was 5 seconds. But I felt, and I tracked it, and I was like, okay, I took a multivitamin every day for a month. And then, okay, what's next after that? Okay, well, maybe I want a better breakfast or better lunches. And then that, you know, better diet, you have better energy. Okay, now I'm going to do 10,000 steps a day or 5,000 steps a day and just do that. Realize that you're building that recipe, one ingredient at a time. But if you really respect the process, the meal is going to turn out great and it's going to work and it's going to be nutritious and it's going to be something you're really proud of and you'll be better for it. And I can't believe that I am where I am looking back on where I was. It is miles away of how I felt, what I could get done in a day. In 2020, I was like, maybe I can shower today and do some laundry if it's a big day. Mm. And now it's like, what I get done in a day, not only is it a long list, and that's not what it's about, but it feels so normal and so achievable. And like, if anyone listening feels that the mountain in front of them is too big to climb, it is. It's a really difficult thing to do. But just start slow and move forward and really add elements to it, one on top of another, and you'll get there. And if anyone wants to talk to me about it privately, reach out to me. You know, of course, Marks, feel free to share my contact information with anyone that reaches out to you, and we can talk about this. There may be something that I mentioned today that you want to unpack a little bit more. I'm available to that. I'm very happy to do that.
That was really powerful. And yeah, I've got a lot of takeaways from this conversation myself. So I know other people listening will do as well. So thank you for being so honest to talking about it in such a real way and give like context to it and how you work through it. So thank you, Eric. I really appreciate you being a guest on a Runner's Life podcast.
My pleasure. It really is. Thanks so much for the time. I really was as therapeutic for me to unload, but I do hope that there's something that I said here today that someone will listen to and say, hey, that clicked. I really hope.
I hope so. And if you do, let us know, let Eric know, let myself know. It really does matter. Sure. So thank you.